You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program, and here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Back to business as usual, ladies and gentlemen, after 2 months of special programming, and we're getting back to business as usual in a big way tonight. You just heard from Kevin McDonald, Paul Fromm, and Tom Sunich. Sam Dixon still on deck for our third and final hour. He's our closer tonight, but I am very eager and excited to welcome an old friend but a first-time guest to the program this hour. Gregory Hood is a staff writer for American Renaissance and the author of Waking Up from the American Dream. He's currently working on a new book called Nationalists Without a Nation. We'll learn a little bit more about that later on tonight. He's going to be speaking at the next American Renaissance Conference. It just got announced at amren.com. It's going to be coming up in August, so go there and get your tickets. Let me tell you something. If you have not had the privilege of hearing Greg Hood deliver an oratory, and that alone is worth the price of admission. I have, and I am testifying to that. Greg, it's great to have you tonight. How are you?
Great to be here. Honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, again, the honor is ours. I've known you for so long, I can't even remember when we first met. I do have the first memory I do have with you is that we were in Atlanta in the late 2000s, and I don't know if it was 2007, 8 or 9, 10 or 11, somewhere around there. Yeah. And I remember driving around with you, and we were doing our thing. But in any event, it's great to have you tonight. So I wanted to focus on some of your a couple of your most recent articles, and then one you wrote a few months ago. And I don't even know if I told you about that one that I want to get to, but we'll get to that in the books and so much more this hour. But first, I think this would dovetail nicely with the topic that we were discussing during the roundtable conversation in the previous hour. One of your most recent articles at amren.com, Deplatforming and Democracy, The Regime Consolidates Its Media. Greg, walk us through that one.
Well, I think what's happening over the last couple of years, especially since 2016, is there's been sort of a conclusion by those in power that we can no longer be trusted to get whatever information we want to make up our own minds because people will make the wrong decision. And what's really happened is the theoretical premise of democracy has essentially been repudiated in the last few years. They used to say things like, well, if people are left alone to their own devices, they'll sometimes get things wrong, but usually they'll make the right choice. The real problem is corporate power. The real problem is elitism. What we really want is to democratize information. And for a brief time with the internet, we actually had that. And what ended up happening was essentially, I mean, a lot of people like to pretend this didn't exist, but what you essentially had was the alt-right. And they're never going to make that mistake again. What we've seen over the last few years is corporate power being praised by the far left as the way things should be. As a matter of fact, I was listening to the roundtable and you were talking about Elon Musk. Elon Musk is getting in trouble right now because he made the mistake of noticing a graphic that showed most crime.
You brought that up, yeah.
Right. And what did Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say? Oh, well, if you keep this up, the only ads are going to be Mr. Pillow ads. Well, I mean, you're essentially saying that corporate America is on your side, and corporate America is one of the most important forces in trying to restrict debate and make sure only certain people have a platform. Well, what does that tell you about the real nature of left and right today? And I think that when you see what happened with Tucker Carlson, particularly the fact that so many different groups and so many different forces, including those within Fox, were moving to get rid of him, even though not that long ago he basically denounced white advocacy in the most crude and over-the-top terms, not that it did him any good. But the fact that this one person was saying something a little bit different than what everybody else was saying, even though it wasn't all that different, and yet this became an existential threat to the regime. And now they're celebrating it as a victory for them, which it is. And I think what we have to take away from this is that the regime, that sounds like such a foreign term. Certainly when we first met, if I had talked about like the American regime, like you would have rolled your eyes because it would have sounded insane. but we can now talk about the regime as a very closed system with very specific people, and only those people are allowed to speak, and only those people are allowed to have a platform. And if somebody else starts building a platform or starts gaining any kind of a following, you will see forces very openly mobilize against him, work to cut him off from not just the megaphone, but also from basic financial services and, as we've even seen, protection of the law. And I think that we are moving toward a closed, we're moving toward a closed system. I mean, they always talk about the open society, but I don't think we can say that America is an open society anymore.
Greg, this is Keith Alexander. You've seen what's been going on over the past week, and it seems to have happened all together. You know, Tucker Carlson, Kevin McDonald, Tom Sunak, James, Paul Fromm, others. Do you think this is a systematic shutdown in preparation for the 2024 election, or do you think this is a coincidence, or do you think it's something in between? Give us your thoughts on that.
I think there are certainly forces within Twitter, within the media, within various companies that are trying to shut down people in preparation, not just for the 2024 election, but for the campaign itself. I mean, at this point, I think that the whatever people think about the 2020 elections and what happened to certain ballots or something like that, I mean, to me, the real fact of the illegitimacy of the election didn't come from whatever people say about voting machines or anything like that, but from the fact that they very openly said, we were not going to let certain views be expressed in the media. We were not going to let certain people be on the air. We were going to make sure that the internet was carefully curated so that only certain narratives could get out there. And perhaps the other side is right when they say that what most people decide is simply a product of the information that they consume, that truth maybe really is just determined from the top down, that's determined by power. But if that's the case, there really is no theoretical basis for democracy. There really is no reason for us to pretend that people should make up their own minds, because if they're too stupid and too dangerous to read magazines or see things on the internet, then why are we letting people vote? Yeah, I mean, this seems like kind of a – this is a flippant point, but like – I mean – what I just said is not flippant, but what I'm going to say next, perhaps, there was a lawsuit that was just concluded not too long ago, and this was about, I believe, vaping. So some state attorney general sued Juul, which is some vaping company, and they came up with a settlement where they basically said the company can no longer market to people under age 35, and then they have to, you know, show these special reports to prove they're not doing this and everything else. And it's like, well, are they saying that people under the age of 35 are literally too stupid to make up their own mind about whether they want to vape or not, but we're supposed to believe that 18-year-olds can vote? I mean, this
is on the other hand,
pretty
Greg,
extraordinary when you think about it.
Yeah, I was going to say this. How in the world could any advertiser be sure that they're not reaching an audience under 35?
You know, it's certainly, I think if you look at the logical implications of what they're saying, and you're going to see this extended to just about everything, that you see this with firearms too, where they'll say that firearms companies are marketing to youth and they need to be restricted and everything else. Well, again, if people cannot be held responsible for the decisions they make because of advertising, perhaps we should be rethinking some of the premises of self-government. And
hold
this
on
is
right
why the
there.
Founders. Yeah.
Now we're getting somewhere. I want to further explore that and other things with the great and good Gregory Hood, staff writer at Amran.com. Don't ever miss anything he writes.
Gregory's in the hood.
Antelope Hill Publishing is America's leading publisher of dissident books, bringing you a wide variety of new translations and original works on every subject from the Spanish Civil War to the funding behind the transgender movement. Antelope Hill publishes books that mainstream publishers won't touch, full of information that challenges the political status quo and brings real culture to the reading public at an affordable price. If you count yourself as a political dissident, then you owe it to yourself to check out the Antelope Hill catalog, with exclusive offerings like Rebel Mountain by Kurt Eggers, a brand new reprint of the infamous You Gentiles by Marie Samuel, and now the treatise of a January 6th prisoner in the American regime. There is something there for everyone, and new titles are added every month. Check out the complete catalog today at AntelopeHillPublishing.com. That's AntelopeHillPublishing.com. I'm James Edwards, and I want you to check out AntelopeHillPublishing.com.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
I'll have to pick up the pace with Gregory Hood because there's so much I want to cover with him this hour, and we're already starting to get a little bit pressed for time, but I want to share a story with Greg, with everyone listening tonight. It's a true story. Some years ago, I don't remember what year, the years all blurred together, but it was several years ago. It was right around the time when Gregory Hood first started writing for American Renaissance, and I was at an Ameren conference, and I was sitting down with Jared and some other fellow travelers, and I said, Jared, you just got the best writer in the movement, hands down and flat out. And I do believe, Gregory, that you are that writer. It's not just that you are the best writer, but the topics that you select are always interesting. I mean, you could write well, but if you're writing about esoteric things that don't draw interest, I don't know how you select the topics that you choose to offer written commentary on, but whatever you're doing, don't stop. We're talking about deplatforming and democracy. And that's one of your articles. I want to move to America Does Celebrate Its Losers in just a moment. But first, just to wrap this up, I want to read a couple of excerpts from the topic at hand. Tucker Carlson, you write that Mr. Carlson says he doesn't know us, but his opponents know him, perhaps better than he knows himself. In a multiracial society, groups that do not organize collectively are trampled. And that's the thing. I mean, we are a collective. We're not individuals. We are a collective, right, just like any other people group. And whether real or imagined, Gregory, the system sees Trump and Carlson as the avatar for whites, and they have certainly been, right, treated as such.
Right. I mean, this is the big thing that I'm trying to get across. And when I have the book out, hopefully in a few months, this is one of the big lessons that I want to impress upon people, was that it doesn't really matter whether you think of yourselves as white. It doesn't matter whether you're ever conscious of having a racial identity. Those with power see you as white. The system treats you as white. People say things like, well, there's no such thing as race. Well, you know what? According to affirmative action, somebody has to be considered white. If people say, what is the definition of white? The people who aren't eligible for affirmative action, that's a pretty good working definition. And we are in this situation, and we are not the ones who get to decide how we're going to be treated. Those with power get to decide how we're going to be treated. So we really only have two alternatives. We can organize collectively and resist, and we can resist as white people because that's the way we're being treated, or we can surrender and just put up with it. And there are no other options.
Well, this is Keith again. As Trotsky said, you may not be interested in the revolution, but the revolution is interested in you.
That's right.
Well, let me ask you this, Greg, before we move on to another excellent recent article that you penned for Amran.com. One more excerpt from Deplatforming and Democracy. You write, nonetheless, Tucker Carlson was unquestionably the most prominent figure who talked about the Great Replacement, anti-white discrimination, and the evils of the American elite. He talked about issues and brought on guests that no other host in his capacity would touch. He may not have been pro-white, but he wasn't anti-white, which is what it takes to stay on the air. Now, let me ask you this. The censorship. Obviously, the consensus is the censorship is needed because people are catching on. We've talked about for years now, going back to 2020 especially, poll after poll after poll seems to indicate a rising level of white racial consciousness. Does that toothpaste go back in the tube now, or will these people continue to just boil below the surface waiting for their moment?
It's a good question. I think there are some things I'm going to say that may not be what everybody wants to hear, but I think that we have to be serious about it. The first thing is that without a viable alternative, people are just going to sit there. It's not necessarily that the toothpaste will go back in the tube, but it's just going to lay on the bathroom sink, making a mess and not doing anything, as opposed to like cleaning one's teeth. And I think that there are a lot of tangents out there, and there are a lot of things that people can chase where you're not really even in the struggle, as far as I'm concerned. You're just off chasing things that don't particularly matter. I mean, to me, the thing that separates those who get it and those who don't are acceptance of the racial issue. I'm not saying that people need to go all that far. I'm not saying that people need to embrace this political solution or that political solution, but one needs to say that white people are being treated poorly as white people and need to fight back as white people. It doesn't even necessarily need to go any farther than maybe we need to scrap the Civil Rights Act and go back to some sort of a colorblind system in the existing American system. That would be as moderate as it would get, but that's still outside the Overton window of political solutions that are available today. And unless people are willing to say that, we're not really going to get anywhere. The second thing is, I think that getting rid of Tucker Carlson was not, people say, well, you know, censorship makes ideas more popular. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but it makes it harder for people to act upon it. The fact is, Tucker Carlson being removed is a victory for the other side. I think they've learned from President Trump. They're never going to let a guy like Trump get a platform again. They're certainly not going to let Tucker get a platform like that again. If you look at a lot of the people who were up and coming with YouTube, some of the people who became some of the most prominent account holders, they're not even necessarily political, but they weren't controlled. They built an audience organically. And now that's no longer true. Basically, everybody of any stature on YouTube at any level is essentially a product, somebody who's been signed off from the top down. Even Twitter, at this point, there are some signs of liberalization under Elon Musk, but there are some signs that things are actually getting worse in some of the accounts that are being purged. And I would be remiss to my employer if I didn't point out that Jared Taylor, despite numerous polite requests and knowing Jared, I'm sure you know how polite he is, that he cannot get his account back, even though I don't think anybody, even our enemies, would say that Jared Taylor ever broke the terms of service.
A gentleman's gentleman. I mean, Jared Taylor,
right.
If anyone in our collective should be allowed on Twitter, it's Jared.
Yeah, people would be like saying the most vile things imaginable, like you deserve to die and everything else. And he'd be like, well, you know, people may disagree on that, but like we need to be reasonable about this.
Greg, this is Keith again. Let me just say this.
Yeah, sure.
I think that the Overton window is constantly shrinking. For example, the Dominion lawsuit being settled by Fox, I think that was to set an example that it's defamatory and actionable if you question the results of an election. I personally don't think that the election was stolen through Dominion machines. I think it was stolen
through the
1965 Voting Rights Act. Okay?
Among other things, I mean, I think basically every election since 1965 has been stolen in that sense, and I think that's the correct way to look at it.
That's where all these bad votes went through black precincts, I guarantee, in Philadelphia, Atlanta, everywhere else. They know how to do it. They've had, 65 years of experience almost now.
Well, I think there's a certain amount of cope even in the election theft narrative, because you're still saying, well, the system itself is still good and legitimate. It's just people breaking the rules and the system being subverted somehow. Well, what if the system itself is the problem? What if the population itself is the problem? I mean,
Since it's black,
that's
though,
a more disturbing thing for people to deal with.
I don't
want to
get too far off in the weeds.
Yeah.
Well, it's not.
No, but I mean, everything is downstream from demographics.
No, I'm talking to Keith.
Here's what I'm saying here. I think that they know that the Republicans will not call out election fraud if it involves black precincts because they would rather be called a pedophile than a racist.
Well, and look, to the extent, I mean, my position on that always was, and we're digressing here, but my position on the whole thing always was, I mean, is it conceivable that there would be fraud? I mean, we know that there was fraud in Chicago in Kennedy's election. There's no doubt about that. So, yes, it's conceivable. Was it fraud on the level that it turned the election? Well, we'll never know.
Well, are we going to tolerate it indefinitely, or are we eventually going to do something about have integrity in our election?
But that's not necessarily what we're here to talk with Gregory tonight about. But in any event, it's an interesting question. Now, the time doesn't permit to for us to segue into America Does Celebrate Losers. We're going to get to that in the next segment. We've got about 2 minutes remaining still, a minute or two remaining in this segment. Greg, is there anything you want to follow up with to put a book into the conversation we've had thus far before we move on?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think we need to really look at the media as the regime, as something more important than the politicians. I mean, one of the things I've often tweeted is AJAB, all journos are name, not word, not used for family radio. And I say that partially joking and obviously a reflection of the all cops are slogan that the other side uses. But I think it's more important than that. Like, journalists are public figures. They're public figures more significantly than politicians are. They bear more responsibility for what they write. And I think what we've seen and we'll see with this subway case in New York City with Jordan Neely, that's a separate issue. We'll see whether the media is actually more important than the law, because as we've seen with other cases, the way the media treats a case determines whether prosecutors move forward or not. And when people say, what is the American regime? More than anything else, I would say the media, those who pay for it, and those who own it.
That's pretty much it. I will tell you before we go to this break that Keith, and I say this in a completely serious way, I mentioned earlier about, for my money, and there's a lot of talent in this movement, a lot of talent that's been suppressed and oppressed and repressed and censored. I say pound for pound, dollar for dollar, Gregory Hood is my guy for the best writer in our movement.
And admit this, admit that I've been after you for years.
Oh, you're a big fan of Gregory Hood. There's no doubt about it. But listen to how he speaks. If we had this man's talent in terms of his writing ability and his ability to articulate a message with the spoken word, we would have made something of ourselves. We'll be right back.
Pursuing liberty, using the Constitution as our guide. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Jerry Barmash. Multiple people have been reportedly shot at a shopping mall in Allen, Texas. Gunfire rang out this afternoon at the Allen Premium Outlets, roughly 30 miles north of Dallas. The mall was in the process of being evacuated, with a large police presence on the scene. WFAA reports one suspect is dead at the mall. CNN reports a manhunt is underway for a second potential suspect. The Collin County Sheriff says there are multiple victims, including children. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is sending quick response teams to the southern border ahead of an expected surge in illegal crossings as Title 42 expires. The governor says the teams are part of his Operation Lone Star initiative he established 2 years ago. The world was watching as for only the second time a British monarch is crowned in front of TV cameras.
God save the king!
God save the king!
For the 40th time at Westminster Abbey, a crown was placed upon a monarch's head.
Bless, we beseech thee, this crown.
King Charles' coronation comes nearly 8 months after he ascended to the throne following the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II. It was Britain's first coronation in 70 years.
I, Charles, do solemnly and sincerely.
Prince Harry's wife, Meghan Merkel, Duchess of Sussex, and President Joe Biden did not attend the ceremony. I'm Jeremy Scott.
President Biden is emphasizing that the debt ceiling and the budget are two separate issues.
I am prepared to negotiate in detail with their budget. How much are you going to spend? How much are you going to tax? Where can we cut?
In an interview on MSNBC, Biden said that budget proposals have never been tied in with the debt ceiling. The GOP-led House passed Speaker Kevin McCarthy's budget proposal last week, and Republicans said they'll raise the debt ceiling if the president agrees to their budget. This is USA News.
Greece is cheap.
But the airfare costs a fortune.
Paris?
Not much closer, and again, airfare...
What about Puerto Vallarta?
Let's face it, flying anywhere is just too expensive.
Wait, what's this? Low-cost airlines.
With one call to low-cost airlines, you'll drastically slash your travel costs. We're talking insanely low airline prices to any of your favorite destinations. Where would you like to go? London, Rome, Costa Rica, Australia?
Wow, that's cheap.
So why wait? Call now to learn how crazy cheap it is to fly anywhere in the U.S. or international. Our prices are so low, we can't publish them. The only way to get them is to call to instantly hear the most amazing best deals on airline travel. It's that easy. So call now and start packing.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
Welcome back, everybody. What a riveting conversation it has been thus far with Gregory Hood of Amren.com. Anytime you see a feature, a posting, anything by Gregory Hood, be sure to read it. You will not be disappointed. We're going to take a radical departure, however, from the conversation we were having during the first half of this hour to the conversation we'll be having for the remainder of this hour. And I want to, as we... This is our first week beyond our annual Confederate History Month coverage, which we do here on TPC every April. And this recent article by Gregory Hood sort of touches on that, I guess you could say, to say the least. America does celebrate losers. And I'm reading now from Gregory's writing. It's the fashion. And this is one good thing from being banned from Twitter. I don't have to see this anymore because I saw it a lot. It's the fashion to call Confederate losers. There was a time when the lost cause was seen as noble precisely because it was lost and the South was the underdog. The Confederate battle flag, you write, Greg, never the symbol of the government, still stands for resistance to power and elite opinion. Nonetheless, at a time when orthodoxy is a requirement for staying online, it's more fashionable to laugh at the Confederacy's defeat. But, as ever, Greg, the system doesn't apply this mockery uniformly, does it?
No, it does not. And certainly, as I'm sure you're about to get to with the article, in this case, what happened, but it's not just this case, it was a town in California where there was a monument to the first American who raised the American flag over this town. The town took it down because now the town is overwhelmingly Mexican demographically, and so they see it as a sign of racial conquest and foreign ownership, essentially. And from their point of view, maybe they're right. But certainly if we're talking about losers, the Mexicans lost the Mexican War. Nonetheless, it is seen as admirable and necessary to celebrate the Mexican cause in that conflict. Certainly American Indian tribes, we can say that they lost their wars against the settlers. However, we must celebrate them all the time. And in fact, the American military has bases and weapons and other things named after American Indians. At the same time, they are taking down the names of Confederate generals. It should also be pointed out, of course, that a lot of these Confederate generals, they didn't just... People say, oh, you know, they were traitors to the United States, they were enemies. Well, they were all pardoned posthumously. They were all given their citizenship back, with very rare exceptions. And most of these guys had fought for the Union, particularly in the Mexican War. And there's a curious kind of patriotism, quote-unquote, right now, where you're actually a patriot if you fought against the United States in the Mexican War for the Mexicans. I suppose the San Patricio's Brigade would be the ultimate example of that. But then you were also a patriot if you were burning down southern towns along with General Sherman in 64 and 65. And what we have is really a kind of patriotism and patriotic narrative that I don't think has ever existed before in history, where the entire history of the country is essentially despicable and something that should be utterly opposed, except for the American Civil War and World War II, in which case we can glory in all the murdering and killing and over-the-top militarism, and you can chest beat about that to your heart's content, but everything else we did was a complete disaster and totally immoral, and we need to feel ashamed about it forever. That seems to be how patriotism works in the United States these days.
Well, hold on, Keith. I want to give it to you right now, but I got to say this, Gregory, to your point. That not that it matters now, but Confederate soldiers, sailors, and Marines who fought in that war were made U.S. veterans. U.S. veterans,
that's right,
by an act,
that's
of Congress, right, in 1957. That's U.S. Public Law 85-425, Section 410, which was approved on May the 23rd, 1958. That made all Confederate veterans equal to U.S. military veterans. We digress, Keith.
Well, Greg, I don't think it's that, puzzling at all. It's quite obvious. They celebrate losers who are non-white, but they will never celebrate any
right,
white losers.
Yes.
That seems to be
that's
the
right,
connecting
that's
of the dots.
That's basically it, yeah.
Well,
it is,
listen,
it is that simple.
Well, you write this, Greg, in this article at Amarin.com, America does celebrate losers. You write, let's also ignore complaints about honoring losers. This country removes statues to its own soldiers in its own conquests. It grovels before losers like American Indian tribes and Mexicans. Conservatives trying to find a civic nationalist justification to what's happening will remain hapless and confused.
That's right. I mean, occasionally you'll see a lot of conservatives very opportunistically seize on the Confederate issue, and they'll throw on words like treason, and they'll talk about betraying the flag. And you saw a lot of this when Confederate statues first started being brought down, and they tried to create this very complicated equation where it was okay for the statues of the Founding Fathers to stay up, but not the statues to Confederate generals, even though, I mean, the War for Southern Independence was as much a war for secession as the American Revolution was. But the people who actually have power, again, the people who matter, and the people who are making these decisions, they don't see these little distinctions. As far as they are concerned, they see statues of racist white men, and they see a country that they used to exist, was able to accomplish things, and they want to extirpate the memory of it. And so they are going to take down statues of anybody associated with those things. To them, Robert E. Lee and George Washington are equivalent, just as they were equivalent in the minds of those Southern soldiers and leaders who rebelled against the Yankee government in 1861. And I think you would agree with me that the woke are more correct than the mainstream in this case. I think they see a connection that's actually there, whereas conservatives have their heads in the sand.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's down to race again. Sam Francis predicted exactly what has happened. He said that they'll come for Jefferson and Washington after they get the Confederate.
Catholic priests. They've even come Columbus. For Lincoln and Churchill now.
Well, and Teddy Roosevelt in New York City. I mean,
there you go.
This is ultimately there's no limiting factor on any of this because
there's race.
There is, but even those people who at the time were liberals and in their own mind certainly didn't regard themselves as racially conscious are still problematic from today's political orthodoxy. I don't think there's anybody who really existed, before 1965, who you can justify still having a statue up. I mean, even somebody like Ulysses S. Grant, certainly General Sherman. I mean, as much as people, you'll see on Twitter, people love to talk about General Sherman burning the South down, they get really uncomfortable once you start bringing up what he said about American Indians.
That's right.
And so by that standard, you really can't have a statue to him either. I mean, this is the fundamental point that I want to make to everybody is that if you go along with orthodoxy, I mean, the nature of the struggle is that it's difficult. We all know that. I don't need to spell that out for anybody. And anybody who's getting involved at this level, I think we're in a better position than we were in, say, 2015, because anybody who's getting involved now knows what they're in for. But the key is that if you go along with orthodoxy, if you say, you know what, I'm just not going to take up the struggle. I'm just going to go along with what everybody else says. If you're a white guy and you're going along with the current system, when you die, it's not that your life meant nothing. I mean, it's actually worse than that. It's that your life meant less than nothing because you're still going to be remembered as a racist. Joe Biden is going to be remembered as a racist, just like de Klerk, who handed over South Africa.
That's right.
Going to be remembered as racist.
And unless
like
you're
Sherman
very
is,
old right now,
right.
You
just
are,
like Sherman is a racist,
you
just
you
like
die.
Grant
Sherman
is a
and
racist.
Lincoln and
every
Churchill.
Single one of these guys are nothing but racist. We will see, if things do not change, we will see Winston Churchill's statues torn down in London while people celebrate. That is what he did. He thought he was fighting for the British Empire, but he wasn't. And that's how it is with all of these struggles that are going on right now. You have to look at it in terms of what is this going to lead to? And what is this going to...
The ultimate thing it's going to lead to, Greg, is this. They're going to get all white people. Unless you're a very old white person, they may well get to you before you
die. Well, this is what Sam Dixon always says. He'll be coming up in the next hour, so we foreshadow that. But they do not raise monuments to Earl Warren. They raise monuments to their people.
Right.
Rosa Parks.
Yeah, and I think one of the... Yeah, right. I think one of the interesting things about this, too, is that, and this gets to my point about the media being the regime, certainly if we look at the kinds of people who are brought up as heroes. Now, there comes a point, I think, when you're a kid and you're studying American history where it just stops being people who actually, you know, did stuff. Explorers, conquerors, pioneers, and it just becomes people who were put up by the media and agitated for the property of other people to be redistributed. Generally, you kind of get to that when you see the civil rights movement. But as we're learning with the so-called heroes of the civil rights movement, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, a lot of the images behind these people don't match with the reality. And they kind of have to shut down the debate surrounding these legendary figures because the truth really isn't all that inspiring, particularly when it comes to a guy like Martin Luther King.
The truth is really that they're just society's chronic malcontents. That's
well, the truth is that they were – there was never a point – we look at like so-called woke people now, and a lot of conservatives say, well, there was a time when it was good, like in the 60s or in the Civil Rights Movement. But what we've actually learned is that it was the same then. It was just harder to get behind the media image. Man. But the same stuff was always happening. And so it's about waking up to the fact that these media lies don't just take place today, but they've been taking place throughout all of history.
Ladies and gentlemen, what a fantastic conversation you're hearing tonight. This is the best we can do it. If anybody can do it better, more power to them. But as far as TPC is concerned, we're giving you our very best shot tonight with the guests and the content you've heard. This is what we do here. We've been doing it for 20 years. We'll be right back.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs. While you're waiting, drop by our Confederate Corner for a free cup of coffee and good conversation. Remember, there are no strangers here, just friends who haven't met yet. Dixie Republic, we're not just a roadside attraction, we're a destination for our people. For more information, visit DixieRepublic.com.
In Message 1, we said that Satan, the father of lies, John 8:44, gave the left evil, spiritual power the more they use the lies. The political left today is the beast. Now the Bible confirms that the dragon gave him, the beast, his power, Revelation 13:2. The extra evil spiritual power that comes from the beast by their lying is what accounts for the string of the leftist criminals in the government that have never yet been prosecuted. It also explains why American capitalists support communism in the 21st century. Note 1. That behavior of capitalists was predicted by Vladimir Lenin, a cell of the beast. Note 2. Henry Ford was a capitalist, and he would have never gone communist. The difference between Ford and the present-day end-time capitalists is that Ford was born and educated in the Kingdom of Christ, 19th century America, the New Jerusalem, Revelation 21.
Welcome back, everybody. An hour with Gregory Hood. Not enough, Greg. You're going to have to make a promise that you'll come back more often. We're talking
anytime.
About your excellent article. Thank you. America does celebrate losers. I want to read from it. We got to really make haste here this segment. This is our last segment with you. And I've got a treat for you. I'm not going to say it's something you didn't know before, but maybe it will be. Keith and I have been looking forward to this all week, presenting this to you here in just a moment. But I read now again from your piece here. Demographics mean more than lines on a map. Power comes from identity. Racial consciousness is the most powerful form of identity politics. Non-whites understand this. Whites don't yet. And going back to the...
Parker Carlson doesn't understand it yet.
Well, go ahead. that's an aside. But going back to the topic at hand, America does celebrate losers. It used to be in a European tradition to honor a vanquished foe. You write that, moreover, Europeans, unlike many other peoples, celebrate the valor of a defeated foe. Americans do the same. There are place names and monuments to American Indians all around the United States. Even when racial consciousness was taken for granted, deadly enemies of the United States, such as Osceola of the Seminoles, were idols for white Americans. Now I have a confession to make. Many years ago, I visited the grave of Osceola. People may be surprised to know that he's actually buried, or his grave at least, is in Charleston, South Carolina. And true to form, I took a picture with his grave because I admired, even then in my early 20s, I admire warriors who face overwhelming odds.
Well, now, William Tecumseh Sherman, you know, Tecumseh was particularly bloodthirsty.
And he was named after him, as Gregory points out in his piece. Now, here's the question to you, and then we'll move on, and we have to move on pretty quickly. What if the Japanese or the Turks had landed on the West Coast before we got there through manifest destiny? You know, there wouldn't have even been a trace of American Indians or their culture left, and certainly no reservations or casinos. They'd have just been disappeared. Only whites were noble enough to set aside land and concessions for these people. The various tribes themselves didn't even offer one another such courtesies. They simply
like the Bell Beaker people.
They simply genocided, raped, and enslaved their rivals out of existence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you want to look at it the way other people's look at these things, I mean, go to Mongolia and look at the giant monument they have to Genghis Khan. This is a guy who exterminated, like, what, 1% of the entire global population, and there's this giant statue of him in silver on horseback, and they're like, yeah, that's our guy. It's pretty awesome, isn't it? And everybody just has to take it. And that's fine. I mean, that's what it is, but it's very... It's hard to take it seriously when people cry these crocodile tears over what whites have done when, by any standard, we've been uniquely merciful, perhaps to our... that was a mistake, as you were pointing out before.
As we can see from this vantage point in history.
Yeah. All right, well, that's a capstone on that one. Now, I want to get back to this. This was something that Keith and I actually covered, Greg, back around Christmas time. It was a couple of weeks before Christmas. And we had come across your most exquisite movie review of the new Elvis film. And I had just watched it the week before with my wife and with my parents. And we watched this. Now, I'm born in Memphis. Keith is a Memphian. And so
Knew Elvis. I live near him. And we've got a gift for you that you will never imagine.
Yeah, we got that coming up.
Oh,
but in any event, everybody in Memphis who was alive at the time has an Elvis story. My parents had the last tickets to his concert that would have been his next concert after his death, so on and so forth. Everybody in Memphis knew Elvis, met Elvis, was his best friend. I mean, that's just the way it goes around here. But in any event, I mean, it is Memphis. But you wrote the definitive movie review, as far as I'm concerned. Now, that was back a few months ago now. But give us a 60-second, maybe 2-minute treatment on what the film, how the film portrayed Elvis, the brand new Elvis movie.
Well, it's pretty interesting the way the film set it up, because they had a certain narrative that they wanted to push, where they basically made it so that the young Elvis was sort of a proto-civil rights crusader who then got in trouble for using black musical styles and was the subject of persecution by segregationists. Then he left for a while, and these same people, because of their bad public relations, killed his mom because of the stress and everything else. And then he came back and did his Vegas shows and was taken advantage of by Colonel Tom Parker. And then he just kind of died, because it seemed that the film didn't really know what to do after the initial ideological thrust, which is him as sort of this campaigner for black liberation in the 50s. Once that was spent, they didn't really know what to do. In actuality, of course, I mean, Elvis certainly was obviously very open to black musical influences and everything else, but it's a bit unfair to him and to blacks, frankly, and everybody else to say that he was just copying them. He certainly had his own spin on it and his own influences that he brought to the table. And more to the point, toward the end of his life, I mean, he was something of a reactionary. I mean, there's that famous photo with him and Richard Nixon. And of course, he went out of his way to get deputized as a federal agent by President Nixon, and spent the end of his life waving guns around and talking about how he was going to bust the hippies because he had studied communist methods of infiltration and brainwashing. and these were the kinds of things that he wanted to fight about. I mean, he was pretty right-wing by today's standards.
Well, look,
at least at the time he died.
You ain't seen nothing yet, Greg.
No.
Wait till this. As Paul Harvey said, this is the rest of the story.
Okay, so here's the thing, Greg. As you know, we've been around for a long time, and being around for a long time, you get a chance to talk to a lot of different people. We actually have interviewed on this program Officer Drew Lackey, who was the officer who fingerprinted Rosa Parks on the night of her arrest in that iconic photo. He later became the chief of police in Montgomery, Alabama. He wrote a book, Another View of the Civil Rights Movement.
Told us so what really happened.
And we've interviewed him. We've had a one-on-one conversation with him. But let me tell you who else we've interviewed, George Wallace Jr. And we interviewed George Wallace's son. It was a little over a decade ago. But he says he had a few memories of Elvis that I'd like to play for you now. And then we'll see if this correlates with the way Elvis was portrayed in the movie and if you had ever heard this before. So I'm going to play a 1.5-minute clip of a revisitation of this interview that Keith and I did in response to your review of this movie. Here we go.
PowerPoint presentation of some of the photographs. We have 333 photographs in the book, James, and I could have had 1,000. So, where do you stop? But interesting pictures of my dad and Elvis. Elvis was a great fan and used to call my father all the time. Elvis just loved him. And so many historical photographs that are fascinating. But
so, you know, Keith, we were talking a couple of months ago about the new Elvis movie. And in the new Elvis movie, they portray Elvis as this staunch integrationist, siding totally with the black side of the civil rights movement. What did you just hear there? What's the actual history? Well, it wasn't just that cut and dry, was it?
Well, he was a supporter of George Wallace, who was supposed to be the incarnation of the devil himself, according to the national news media. Basically, what he's saying is that these people nowadays that want to claim that everybody that lived through that era was either a closeted left-winger or they were the devil incarnate, they're just missing reality.
I want to play.
We need to talk about the reality of what things were back then.
If you're interested to hear more about Elvis and George Wallace, listen to this.
It's very interesting about Elvis. Elvis used to call him all the time. He was a big fan of my dad's. He told him one time that he had a Wallace the President sign on the front lawn of Graceland in 68. But after my father was injured in 72, Elvis would call quite often and offer him his various vacation spots around the world, and he said, George, I'll come pick you up on my jet, and we'll just go wherever you want to go. My dad never did the decline and was graceful and thanked him, but Elvis was a big fan, and
Greg, that didn't make it into the movie, did it?
I mean, no, somehow they overlooked that. I can't explain it. I mean, you would think that
in the movie he's an antagonist to Senator Eastland, and he goes to B.B. King to get all of his wisdom and moral compass, and obviously very upset when Martin Luther King was shot.
They left out the senator's relationship with Joe Biden, too. I can't explain how they overlooked that.
Well, they certainly left out that Elvis had a George Wallace for President yard sign in his lawn.
They certainly left that out, too.
And that, obviously Wallace, more than probably anyone, even more than Faubus and others, known as the
segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
Your thoughts
are that didn't make it in the movie. I mean, it actually rings true. I mean, if you look at what Elvis represented, I mean, I think that there probably was in the early going, certainly a kind of sense that, well, maybe everybody can participate in this American way of life. But it certainly that had completely collapsed by the end of the 60s. And he was very much outspoken against the Beatles and a lot of these things that had sort of taken root based on what he had actually done. And
John Lennon said that he was just a Southern redneck. And
Elvis was from rural northwest Mississippi, and that's from where my grandparents were from. And believe me, Tupelo in the 1935 when he was born,
Tom Parker made him keep a lid on it, but he was typical. He was a typical white Southerner of the time.
And typical white Southerners got along with rural blacks in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. Yes, I mean, no problem at all.
Right. And I think that what the film was trying to do is there was a lot of attempts to try to cancel Elvis, of course, lately too. And so what they basically said is they created an image of him that didn't fit reality to try to make him relevant to the younger generation as like a proto hip hop figure or something like that. Yeah. And of course, if you just look into it for 10 seconds, the whole thing falls apart, but they count on people not being able to do that.
Well, I was when we read your review of the film, I recalled so many years prior that interview with Wallace and I and with George Wallace Jr., and I vaguely remembered him saying something about Elvis. So we went back to the archives, we pulled it up, and revisited it back in December of 2022, a few months ago. And anyway, I was looking
forward. It's amazing
forward,
what we have
that's
in our
fantastic,
archives.
Fantastic, yeah.
looking forward
that's
to
a great
playing
interview.
That for you tonight.
Yeah.
Well, he goes on from that. I mean, the whole interview is great. The whole interview is just things about Wallace no one has ever heard before. At least I had never heard before. I mean, how he talked to Arthur Brimmer, who attempted to assassinate him, and said he wanted to see him in heaven. I mean, it's just things you'd never heard about Wallace before. But anyway, Greg, we got a minute remaining. We want to have you back soon. Waking Up from the American Dream, that's a book you wrote some years ago. You've got a new book you're working on, Nationalists Without a Nation. How can people get the first book, and where can people look forward to finding the new book? Got about 30 seconds left.
Well, the first book is still available from Countercurrents Publishing. That's countercurrents.com with a hyphen in between Counter and Currents. And the new book should hopefully be out about a year. And as soon as that's out, it'll be available from New Century Foundation. So,
well,
amron.com.
We will talk to you again between now and then. I am sure we will see you at the next American Renaissance Conference. In the meantime, folks, every one of his articles, amron.com. He's the best. He's the gold standard. Gregory Hood, what a fantastic hour. We will talk to you again soon. Thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much.
Godspeed.
Godspeed.
Stay tuned, everybody. Third hour up next.